1649 to St. George's Hill. A ragged band they called the Diggers came to show the people's will. They defied the landlords, they defied the laws. They were the dispossessed, reclaiming what was theirs. We come in peace, they said, to dig and sow. We come to work the lands in common and to make the waste grounds grow. This earth divided, we will make whole. So it will be a common treasury for all. The sin of property we do disdain. No man has any right to buy and sell the earth for private gain. By theft and murder they took the land. Now everywhere the walls spring up at their command. They make the laws to chain us well. The clergy dazzle us with heaven or they damn us into hell. We will not worship the God they serve, the God of greed who feeds the rich while poor men starve. We work, we eat together, we need no swords. We will not bow to the masters or pay rent to the lords. We are free men, though we are poor. You diggers all stand up for glory, stand up now. Men of property, the orders came. They sent the hired men and troopers to wipe out the diggers' claim. Tear down their cottages, destroy their corn. They were dispersed, but still the vision lingers on. You poor take courage, you rich take care. This earth was made a common treasury for everyone to share. All things in common, all people one. We come in peace, the orders came to cut them down.
Hello, this is Kevin Annett, Eagle Strong Voice, and you're listening to Here We Stand, one of the voices of the Sovereign Republic of Canada and the global resistance movement. Today is Bastille Day, July 14th, 2024, and this is, for now, the final live broadcast of Here We Stand, as we transition to a new media platform. Today on this program, our aim, like on every broadcast, is to inspire and educate you to do more than listen, and to carry on the long fight to reclaim our minds, our lives, and our world. It's appropriate we conclude Here We Stand on Bastille Day, for when the people of Paris attacked the Bastille prison on this day in 1789 and sparked the French Revolution, they not only wiped out the authorities, but threw open the doors of the prison cells and liberated the inmates. And yet most of those prisoners refused to budge from their cells. They were too accustomed to the security of their dungeons. They were terrified of freedom. Well, some things never change, folks, because now as then, a doorway out of slavery has been opened through which the people can emerge. Because our common law republic movement has birthed a global revolution. We have toppled the oldest bastille in history, the Vatican. We have overthrown popes and other monarchs through our common law courts and republics, and thereby have opened a new way for an enslaved humanity to escape from a genocidal corporatocracy. But very few people have stepped out of their mental and physical prisons, taken responsibility for themselves and our world, and joined us in the fight for self-governance and liberty. The shackles of fear, routine, dependency and conformity, and of overt mind control are still too firmly in control of the mass of people, including many of the so-called awake ones. The truth is that over the past decade, very few of you have gone beyond passive listening to this show to actively engaging in the fight to reclaim ourselves and our world, despite the knowledge, training, and other tools we've offered you. As we've often said on the show, it's only a remnant of humanity, a leadership cadre of veteran fighters, who are now engaged in the battle to defeat our tyrannical enemy. It is that remnant who are carrying on this fight and who are the true citizens of our common law republics. This organized and active minority will, like in any revolution, lead the sluggish majority in battle and let them learn from their own struggles how to be new, self-governing, and free citizens of a sovereign republic. To achieve that purpose, our Global Republic Alliance movement is focusing its efforts offline, locally, and in direct actions that undermine and destroy the old corporate system while raising up a new society. We're forming local republic cells, assemblies, and common law courts to displace and replace that old system. We are reclaiming the land and wealth of the corporatocracy and its church and state partners in crime. And we are raising and training citizen militias to defend our new republics on the ground. This movement didn't begin yesterday. It is a culmination of more than 30 years of struggle that began in the campaign to expose and prosecute the church and state genocide of Indigenous people and their mass murder of children across Canada. I've had the honor and the advantage of initiating and leading that campaign since 1992. I've seen it evolve from merely protesting genocide to putting the criminal rulers on trial and beginning to disestablish their blood-soaked system. The issue in our fight became what we were to replace the system with, and how could we do so when everyone is tainted by its corruption and complicity? How are we to raise up a new generation of free people who take responsibility for the world and themselves so that tyranny would not rise again? Well, this has never been an abstract question for me or for any of the handful of survivors from that campaign. It is simply a matter of life and death. We have had to fight back and never give up because our lives and the lives of children depend on it. And in the course of never giving up over the years, we have been changed. We have lost our fear and self-concern, like any soldiers do once they've been under fire. We have learned to think and act in a new way as permanent fighters, recognizing that we are in a long war with a ruthless enemy whose aim is to exterminate humanity. And the few of us who have been so transformed are inspiring others to enter the battle so that they too can be changed by their experiences, by their suffering, and by their wounds into fellow leaders of the only fight that matters. But showing up is half the fight. Nothing can be learned or changed on the sidelines. To be armed for this fight, we must know ourselves and our enemy, but we have to also know the lessons gained from the long history of our movement. The truth that we've exposed about crimes against humanity in our own backyard has mostly been erased from the public mind. That truth and our collective memory must be revived now in a global climate of censorship and mind control. Why has our 30-year exposure of infanticide, of child torture and murder by church, state, and big money caused such fear in our enemy and evoked such repression, such cover-up and censorship? Why? Because by showing how Indigenous people were targeted and destroyed, we inadvertently revealed the brutal methods and nanotechnologies now being deployed against all of us by the COVID corporatocracy. We also showed by our example how even the biggest tyrant can be brought down using common law courts established by we the people. We proved that when we deposed Queen Elizabeth and Pope Benedict in Rome during 2013. And so study our chronology of this fight, of how we won. Study its priceless evidence you can find online at murderbydecree.com and on our blog radio programs, which will be archived at bbsradio.com/herewestand. Look at it all and learn and pass on to the next generation how we have fought and won. Because the genocide we unearthed has become now a global omnicide that threatens to destroy every vestige of a free humanity and the natural law. How do we contend with this tyranny and threat? We do so by embodying its opposite in ourselves and among ourselves. By turning the world upside down and making the last first and the first last. By making this revolution real enough to depose and replace the. That's what we fought for over 30 years. That's what we're fighting for now in Canada within the new independent sovereign Republic of Canada. And it's the message for the rest of today's program. Because today on the show, we'll be listening to a spiritual reflection called The World Turned Upside Down. It's designed to give us the vision of what we're striving for. And also a lecture I gave, or was to give, at Oxford University in 2016. Where I speak of both Vatican crimes and the nature of our biggest and oldest, the satanic power known as the Church of Rome. Because we must strip back the mask behind and covering our real enemy and see it for what it is if we're to fight and defeat it. Well, to that end, people, I am beginning a global speaking tour on September 2nd in cities across Canada, America, and Europe. And you can learn more about that tour and how it's going to be actively organizing the resistance and the new republics on the ground. For more information, you can write to me at angelfire101@protonmail.com. In closing, I want to thank my program's operators, Doug and Don, for their tireless support over the past decade, and thank all of you who have remained loyal listeners and have shared our work with the world. Let us keep faith with one another, now and always, in our long struggle to end tyranny, genocide, and murder, and reclaim the world, and remake the world for all its people. This is Kevin Annett, Eagle Strong Voice. Stand by for more. MurderByDecree.com, RepublicofKanata.org. I thank you.
Hi, everyone. This is Kevin Annett, Eagle Strong Voice again. I'm giving you today a sermon for the third Sunday in Advent. That's the upcoming Sunday, December 15th, 2019. And this is part of an ongoing series called God's Revolution, a radical reading of Scripture for refugees from false religion. It's sponsored by the Covenanters, a separatist political and spiritual movement. Today's gospel is taken from Luke chapter 1, verses 46 to 55. It's sometimes called Mary's Song of Praise, announcing the birth of Jesus, or the Magnificat. But I call today's sermon an outcast's victory, the world turned upside down. And when you read Mary's words, and you go back to the original Greek, once again, you get a very different message from what you see printed in the Bible. Mary's words are, "My soul grows and rejoices, for in my poverty I am chosen to do great things. Because of me, rulers are pulled down from their thrones and destroyed, and the lowly are raised up and exalted. The hungry are filled with all that is good, and the rich are banished and sent away empty." Well, all of this reminded me of a woman named Karen Connerly. Karen was someone who people tried not to notice, especially in church. She was poor and bedraggled. She was Aboriginal and pregnant, and she was barely 16 years old. On the morning we met, Karen stood tentatively on the edge of our congregation with a look of what I thought at the time was fear. In fact, she had arrived that day to overturn our world. At the time, I had been the minister of St. Andrew's United Church in Port Alberni for barely a year, and my life seemed wonderful, content and happy. Our Port Alberni congregation had tripled in size, and everyone seemed quite content. They were especially delighted on Sundays when my little infant daughter, Eleanor, used to toddle to the front of the service during my sermon and insist that I pick her up. So I'd stand there and preach with Eleanor in my arms, and that delighted especially the elderly ladies in the congregation. Now, at the time, in my joy, I couldn't imagine how that was all about to change forever. Well, when Karen Connerly appeared that Sunday in our church in the fall of 1993, it didn't really alarm a lot of us at first because a few local Indians had already begun to attend the service. The local New Chelmouth Indians had begun to accept my invitation to come to church. But they were mostly affluent natives. They were tribal council people, and they kept to themselves, which pretty much suited my white parishioners just fine. As for me, I was feeling pretty proud of myself that I had been able to seat Indians alongside whites, which was the first in our church, and to have Indians and whites sitting together on Sundays. It was also a first anywhere in Port Alberni. Even though at the time, despite feeling that pride, I didn't know the conditions, the homegrown slaughter that my own church had perpetrated on the local natives that was responsible for that ongoing apartheid in our community. Well, Karen Connerly changed all of that. She did it in the way anyone does who is living on the edge and can't afford to hide the truth by being polite or considerate. Well, I knew something was afoot when Karen walked into the church, and she didn't sit down with the rest of us after our opening hymn. She stood at the back of the sanctuary and just stared at me. One of the ushers went up and spoke to her, but she shook her head and barked something that made heads turn. I was weighing what to do when suddenly she began shuffling towards me at the front of the church, and even before her wailing began, I could see that she was crying. Her words rocked the church. She cried out, "They killed my baby! They killed my little Charlie!" Well, at that point, an usher named George Geddes got up, and he went over to the woman and actually put her in an arm lock. And the congregation exploded at that point in cries and shouts of outrage. Of course, I didn't know if they were outraged at what she was doing or what George was doing to her. Anyway, she tried to wrestle free, but another guy got up, grabbed her as well. And at that point, I just came down out of the pulpit. I hurried to them because I was dumbstruck that men that I thought I knew were perpetrating such sudden violence on this little Indian woman. I got the ushers to back off. I guided Karen to an empty pew, and I sat her down, and then I asked everyone around me to just sit down and calm down. Well, Karen then poured out her story to me. She described what had happened, and people sat in a stony silence while others got up and hurried out of the church. I was advised later by my board that I should have let George and his buddies manhandle the inconvenient Indian out of church so that the service could have continued in peace. But even then, as obtuse as I was, I knew that something else, something more important was at work than just church business as usual. Karen Connerly was a single mother. She lived on welfare in the midtown slum area of Puerto Bernie that's still called the ghetto. It's where mostly Indians live. She'd been raped by her father and by uncles at the local Seychelles Indian Reservation, and so she lived in hiding in the ghetto with her one-year-old son, Charlie, and her newborn daughter, the one who was not yet born in her womb. One day, little Charlie began to cough uncontrollably, and soon he turned blue and went into convulsions. So, in a panic, Karen carried him up to West Coast General Hospital and asked for their help. But the emergency room staff turned Charlie away. I was appalled when I heard that. I was oblivious to the emptying pews around me. I was just focused on Karen. I said, "What, you mean they wouldn't help him?" She shook her head and said, "They just let him die." The nurse said, "They don't treat Indians." Well, after that, Karen sat with the corpse of her little boy at a bus stop near the hospital. She sat there till morning, until a Mountie found her and actually arrested her, and then she was charged with manslaughter in the death of her own son. No one believed that it was the hospital that had killed Charlie. "It's how they treat us here," Karen explained, after she calmed down a bit. "It's always been that way for us, but they're not going to kill this one," she said, and she patted her swollen belly. Well, everything changed after that day. For me, especially. The thrones in my mind began to topple for me. I opened my heart and my door to many more of Karen's people and to the legions of other murdered Indian children that still lie in unmarked graves up at the United Church Alberni Indian Residential School. And that change spread from me and around me. It eventually began a political and a spiritual firestorm across Canada and across the world that's begun to overthrow a genocidal church and state system and turn everything upside down. Well, many centuries ago, there lived a woman a lot like Karen Connerly. She, too, was unwed, poor, outcast. She, too, was pregnant with a child and with a revolution, a new presence in the world that would make the last first and the first last. That woman's name, of course, was Mary, and she was chosen to bring Jesus the Christ into the world. Well, today's gospel reading from Luke chapter 1 speaks of that revolution. It's often called the Magnificat. Unfortunately, the Christian church has surrounded this tale with a lot of cultic imagery and belief about a so-called virgin mother of God. But Mary was not a virgin. The church only calls her that because of a Latin mistranslation of the Greek word for young woman. Very young woman. Because Karen was a teenager, so was Mary. They were likely very young. Mary was as poor and as human as Karen Connerly, and as human as Jesus himself. Mary sung a praise that we read in today's gospel reading, is like John the Baptist's announcement that we heard last week about the coming of Jesus. This song of praise is intended to prepare people for Christmas and the imagined Bethlehem birth narrative, but once again, myth gets in the way of fact, because as we know, Christmas has nothing to do with Christianity. December 25th was the Roman festival called Saturnalia, otherwise known as the time for reversal. For on that day, the slave owners would take off their robes and be the servant to their slaves, who would become the masters, for the day at least. That's no accident. The same great reversal, the turning of the world upside down, is at the core of Mary's song of praise. By naming Saturnalia as Jesus' birthday, the earliest Christians were saying, this is the consequence of the justice that Jesus has ushered into the world. All the rulers are pulled down, and the poor everywhere are raised. Now, pull down, that phrase in Greek. The Greek word for that is katareo, which means to utterly destroy, to obliterate, so they're not there anymore. Rulers of one over another, the rule of one man over another, is obliterated. Well, clearly by that, it's obvious that a radically new world is coming into being for a purpose not so obvious at first. It's often been said that the best way to tame a revolutionary idea is to turn it into a religion. Well, that's certainly happened with Christianity, because if you merely worship someone, you don't have to take him seriously. And so the radical message of Jesus of human equality and liberation was quickly contained and mythologized by the wealthy corporate church of Rome into a cult ritual that really smothered the power of Jesus' words and message. That religious cult killed the memory and spirit of Jesus and made him a sacrificial atonement for so-called human sin, a heresy called Roman Catholicism, that like all worldly empires, creates shame and humiliation in people in order to control them. But that degrading spirit is the opposite of what we hear today in Mary's triumphant song of praise. Her song is imbued with a force that breaks apart oppression and elevates humanity above itself. It shows us that even in our loneliness, we are chosen to fulfill a higher purpose and remake the world according to divine justice. Well, not surprisingly, as you can imagine, I used to get in trouble with my staid theology professors about this gospel reading. Its revolutionary message was not obvious to them as it was to me. In fact, it frightened my profs because, like Jesus' overturning of the money changers in the Jerusalem temple, it was outside their experience and went against their perceived interests. Richard Leggett was a particularly fat theologian who taught me Bible studies, and he used to get mad at me. He'd say, no, these texts can't be taken literally. Mary didn't literally mean the rich when she said they were sent away hungry. It's a spiritual allegory. She meant anyone who's inwardly impoverished. And toppling rulers from their throne, well, that's just a reference to Satan, not to earthly rulers. Well, I remember answering him, well, then how about when Jesus says that a rich man can no more enter heaven than a camel can pass through the eye of a needle? Doesn't that mean it's impossible for the rich to go into heaven? Well, Big Dick smiled at me smugly, always quick with an answer, and he said, no, the eye of the needle refers to a little-known gate in Jerusalem. It's small, but you can still crawl through it if you try. How convenient. And on ad nauseum. Over the years, I've learned that belief for most Christians is determined not by their faith as much as by their salary and pension plan. Fortunately, Jesus didn't have either. Well, to illustrate all this and to go deeper in today's gospel message, let's examine its key words from Luke chapter 1, verses 46 to 55, if you want to follow along. Mary's first words in this passage are telling. She says, my soul magnifies the Lord. Well, the words in Greek for soul is psyche, which means substance or breath. And the word for magnifies is megaluno, which means to declare or to make greater or better. My soul magnifies the Lord seems to be saying that Mary herself is somehow making God better. She's making God more than God. Mary is the subject of the sentence. God is the object. Mary is acting upon God and perhaps on the godness within herself. But then the rest of the passage seems to reverse that. It has Mary saying that God is choosing her to bring down the mighty and elevate the poor despite their lowly status. But this is ultimately Mary's song, and the first words situate Mary as the cause of everything that follows. It's amazing. Well, let's avoid the temptation of interpreting that meaning to somehow cultify Mary into godlike status, as the Church of Rome has done. In fact, what's being described in Luke 1:46 is fully human and reveals the majesty of being fully human. If there is divine greatness in our world, it is because of the courage and the witness of the human soul. The mystery called God has taken flesh in every child born and awaits like a seed in us to flower into the life of one like Jesus, who by being fully human was fully divine. Well, when you think about it, it's an incredible revelation. It puts an end to religion and to the world as we know it, where we're expected to always defer to some other authority figure and wait upon salvation and meaning to be delivered by somebody else. That evolution away from that childhood notion into godness within, understanding of our wider place in the world. That evolution is evident when you simply read through the Bible, the way it progresses. I mean, isn't it evident from a complete reading of the Bible that we are already in a direct and unmediated relationship and partnership with the great mystery that we call God? Because as it progresses, God, the idea, the impression of God, and perhaps the nature of God changes. He evolves from a vengeful, judgmental ruler into a state of unconditional love. Well, in the same way that that child matures from self-absorption and understanding, our soul journey as a people is bringing to birth a better divinity through our willingness to accept the risk and the cost of being human, of existence. The mystery grows and evolves through us as we become more than ourselves. The ancient Greek writers and the person who authored the book of Job depict how man rises above God by persevering in the truth, whatever the cost, despite our mortality, despite our weakness. The Greek playwright Aeschylus wrote, "The gods look with envy upon man because, although living for but a day, he surpasses the Olympians by still daring to love and to be valiant." It's beautiful. And it's all true. Like Karen Connerly and every woman who courageously brings forth life into a world of suffering and death, Mary sings in triumph because she knows that whatever comes, she's created a chance for all of us, the possibility of a new world where the old corruption is toppled. And perhaps her particular joy was to know that her own son would bring about that new way by lighting a fire and a sacred spirit in humanity that would never go out. Karen Connerly's New Chelmsford people have a story that once Christ visited their West Coast tribes, many centuries before the whites ever appeared. The Christ, who came to them as a woman, warned the New Chelmsford that a pale people would come to their land carrying her name and words, but they would lack her inner spirit, her teachings. The teaching that said that all of God's creatures would be loved and respected and treated equally. Well, the Christ told the New Chelmsford that the pale Christians had lost that soul, and so they were to welcome them and lead them back to her true way. The New Chelmsford tried to do so, and they were slaughtered for it, just like Jesus was. But as with him, that spirit cannot be killed by cannon fire or smallpox or by big money. That promise rests within all of us. It's immortal. It waits to be born fully human and remake our world by first turning upside down everything inside us and around us. Well, the week after I was fired by the United Church for uncovering its crimes against her people, Karen Connerly came back. She appeared in my church one final time. She had heard what had happened to me, and she came there to support me. But when she saw that I was no longer there in the pulpit, she stood up in the service, and she declared, "You're crucifying Kevin just like you did us, but God sees what you're doing, and you're going to come down." And at that point, Karen again was grabbed and finally, like me, evicted from St. Andrew's United Church. And soon after that, she was found dead. But crucifixions have never ended anything. What Karen predicted has come true, for by her courage, she has birthed it into being. The rulers are falling, the dead churches are collapsing, and the silenced victims are standing up and speaking and reclaiming the world. Well, I've seen this revolutionary miracle. I know it to be true because I've helped birth it into being. I pray for all of you that you may come to know and give life to the same Magnificat, the divine word taken flesh among us, to topple the ruler of this world and to bring to being a new creation. This is Kevin Annett, Eagle Strong Voice. Remember, live it. Thank you. Good evening, I'm Kevin Annett, and tonight I'm going to give you a lecture that I was to present to the Oxford Union, which is the oldest debating society in the world. In April 2016, I was invited to come there, in Oxford University in England, and debate a cleric of the Catholic Church over the issue. Funnily enough, the topic was, is there any good in the Roman Catholic Church? Well, as so often happens on these occasions, the invitation to me was unexplainably withdrawn about 2 weeks before the event, and the debate between me and him never happened. So I thought it would be good to post online for the world to see exactly what I was going to say that night. Good evening.
Let me begin by saying what a pleasant surprise it is to be able to join you all here tonight. The last time I tried to give a public talk in England, at a London rally to protest child trafficking by church and state, your privately run UK border agency saw fit to arrest, fingerprint, jail me, and then finally deport me from your country without giving a reason at all. So be that as it may, and it usually is, I especially want to thank you for having me here tonight, having the courage to have me here tonight. Tonight's topic for debate is framed rather tellingly. Is there any good in the Roman Catholic Church? And assumably by that is meant its holding company, the Vatican Incorporated. Well, the very wording of the subject's interesting because it implies that no, there isn't any good at all. Let's search for some. Of course, trying to locate integrity in a corporation is like looking for love in a brothel. So perhaps the question of tonight's debate's already been answered. My job's done, we can all go home. In any event, the title of the main event tonight is a bit confusing, beginning with the term good, which is, after all, a completely relative and morally ambiguous term. The Spanish conquistadors and their slaughter-blessing Catholic priests thought that they were doing good when they wiped out millions of non-Catholic people for their own good. The Vatican's Inquisition that barbecued and tortured to death Christians who disagreed with Rome was officially entitled an auto de fe, which means act of faith. Even the present so-called liberal Pope Francis, Jorge Bergoglio, speaks of the goodness and zeal of the Franciscan missionaries who worked to death thousands of Aboriginal men, women, and children on Catholic slave plantations in California. Well, some things never change. Bergoglio also recently pardoned some 10,000 of his own child-raping priests, no doubt in the same spirit of doing good, at least good for his own institution. Human beings, especially when goaded on and justified by religion, always adorn their crimes in a halo of goodness. I've had personal experience of what I speak about. For over 20 years in Canada, I've lived and worked and documented alongside these folks who have lived through the story, the reality of genocide in Canada, perpetrated mostly by Catholic-run Indian residential schools, where over 60,000 children died. Half of these children never came back because at the hands of the priests and nuns, they were ritually tortured, routinely starved, trafficked, experimented upon, flogged, gang-raped, and killed en masse with smallpox and tuberculosis. Not one Catholic priest has ever gone to trial for any of these crimes, nor will they. These killers are above the law as it stands now. And having had the misfortune of speaking with enough of these scum, I know that these complicit clergy are still convinced that they were only trying to do good to the little brown savages by killing their bodies to save their souls, to quote their buddy Thomas Aquinas, one of the founding theologians of the Catholic Church. So perhaps what we need to do is redefine the term good in a better way, using this simple definition. To do good means to do no harm to others and to let them be themselves. Of course, under that definition, you immediately disqualify and condemn the Roman Catholic Church, which has killed more people than any institution in human history. The Church of Rome's body count is well over 50 million corpses, ever since it was made a legal corporation by the Emperor Constantine in the year 317. All right, that may all be true, sputter the defenders of Rome. So nobody's perfect. But look at all the charitable works the Church does all the time. Isn't that good? Well, in that sense, perhaps tonight's topic for debate should have been entitled instead, Was There Any Good in Pablo Escobar, the head of the criminal syndicate known as the Medellin Drug Cartel? Because Pablo engaged in lots of charitable good works for the poor folks of Colombia. Just like the Roman Catholic Church, of which he was a dues-paying member, Pablo used his ill-gotten loot to build shelters for the homeless, playgrounds for some slum kids, and soup kitchens for the hungry. Of course, that charitable money was covered in blood and paid for by the early deaths from drug addiction of the very same people he was helping, but still, he was doing some good, wasn't he? Now, my analogy between Pablo Escobar and the Vatican is more than fitting, since not only are they members of the same club, but also the Vatican Bank is heavily invested in the international drug cartels, as well as the arms and human trafficking industries that go along with it. GMO companies, Big Pharma, the biggest small arms company in the world, Beretta Limited, even dozens of online internet porn companies, all of these 100% Vatican investments pay for the goodies doled out to those deserving poor people who kiss the claw that feeds them. But let's take on directly the suggestion that the Roman Catholic Church, as the world's richest and least accountable corporation, plays a major role in providing charitable sustenance to the world's needy. Let's ask, what percentage of the Church's annual revenue actually goes towards charitable works? Well, it's an important question, not only for the debate tonight, but because the only legal basis for the Church to be exempt from paying taxes under the Law of Nations is that they must devote all, not some, but all, of their collected revenue for either the advancement of religion or charitable works. Well, right there, you can knock out the Roman Catholic Church unless someone wants to explain what money laundering for the mafia, buying cruise missiles for third world dictators, or issuing routine bribes to politicians and governments all over the world have to do with either religion or charity. What percentage of the Catholic Church's revenue goes towards charity? Actually, less than 1%, at least in America. For tellingly, that's the only country in the world where the Church consistently publishes any of its financial records. After all, the Vatican is a closed, self-governing, totally unaccountable body, like any secret criminal society. But that inconvenient, lingering notion of a separation of church and state found in the American Constitution requires that even the Catholic Church has to create an appearance of transparency. And so, according to the U.S. government, in the year 2013, the Roman Catholic Church in America had a net revenue of $13.4 billion. And that's just in one country, where only about 15% of the world's Catholics live. By projection, the annual income of the Vatican must be in the hundreds of billions of dollars, not just from all those collection plates from those saps, but also from its massive global investment portfolio and its secret financial concordat agreements with over 100 governments that channel a regular percentage of your tax money into the Vatican Bank and all of its criminal behavior. But coming back to America, the one country where a light is shone on the murky underworld of Vatican finances, according to the same self-audit of the Catholic Church, of the $13.4 billion raked in during 2013, only 1.1% of it went to charity. But since half of that amount came from government grants to Catholic aid societies, in reality, a whopping 0.6% of the income went from the bank accounts into charities. But since those charities are mostly owned and operated by the Church itself, it just means that one hand of the octopus is feeding the other. Quite brilliant, don't you think? One half of 1%, friends. The truth is that the Roman Catholic Church is not a force for charitable works. Just look at the books. It's in fact a huge criminal racket, a money-sucking corporation that kept afloat by every taxpayer in the world. Okay, so let's turn to the other basis for the Church not paying a dime of taxes, the advancement of religion. What percentage of its time and money goes towards advancing its particular, and I might say extremely violent, religious creed? Less than 10%. That's the time each week a priest spends conducting prayers, masses, or catechism classes, according to the Church itself. According to a statement from the Vatican's Governing College of Cardinals, who in 2014 issued an internal report concerning the training and ordination of its priests. The main job of the clergy, according to the Cardinals, is the material and social upkeep of the Church, guarding the building, the safeguard of its traditions and operations, and the expansion of its income and membership. Like in any big corporation, somebody somewhere tell me where God, let alone Jesus Christ, enters into that whole mess. Okay, strike two. In case you didn't know, that's a baseball term. I don't play cricket. The third and final strike against the Roman Catholic Church, and you got to watch out that for that term because the word Catholic means universal, which it is not. The final strike against the Catholic Church lies in its real and not imagined nature. Once its enormous pretense and lie is pulled back and we see it for what it is historically and today. But to do so and to pierce the mental fog surrounding the Vatican Incorporated, we have to realize that the papacy is not a Christian church at all. On the contrary, it is in every respect a cult of emperor worship derived from late 3rd century Rome, not from the historic Jesus, not even from the early Christian church. This fact is crucial if we're to deal with the mental confusion of many people, atheists included, who ponder helplessly, but how can a body that preaches about the love of Jesus cause mass murder, genocide, and institutionalized child rape? Of course, the simple answer to that is that it's always the worst child rapist in town who has the most sterling reputation. The latter is needed as a cloak by any crook. The bigger the felony, the sweeter the coating. Talk, my friends, is easy, especially from a pulpit. But let's not forget what Jesus himself warned. Quote, "Many false prophets will come in my name and say, I am the Christ. But do not be fooled. By their works you shall know them." Bingo. By their works you shall know them. Well, we can see the works of the papacy all too well. Conquest, brutality, just wars, genocide, inquisition, and the crushing of the human spirit. And it all began when the Roman emperors Aurelian and Constantine created the Roman Catholic Church on the murdered bones of the early Christian Church. The church was an extension and continuation of that other big killing machine called the Roman Empire. Proof of this, you don't have to look any further than the Pope's official title, which is Pontifex Maximus, which in Latin means the great bridge between, guess where, heaven and earth. That was the Latin title of the emperors of Rome, starting with Aurelian in the year 275, who also assumed the title Deus et Dominus, means God and Master. One man who's become God. Well, first that was the emperor, but now today to a Catholic, it's the Pope. Christ is no longer the link to God, but a man is. Elected and elevated blasphemously over humanity, even over God, by other old men in funny hats. Well, not surprisingly, every newly elected Pope is also given the title Vicari Christi, which is even more blatant. In Latin, it means the replacement of Christ, the one who replaces Christ. In black and white, it's right there. Catholicism, papism, is the replacement of Christianity, an empire of conquest and wealth relying on the means of the world and not the way of Christ. Just look at the body count. And listen to these admissions of guilt right from the horse's mouth, or I should say ass. Statements from various popes down the centuries that have never been contradicted or repudiated by any of their successors. Pope Boniface in 1302. "We declare it is necessary for every human creature to be subject to the Roman pontiff." Pope Leo in 1520. "The pope is Christ himself on earth." Pope Pius in 1929. "Fascism is simply the doctrines of our faith made the law in government." Pope John in 1962. "No man may enter into Christ unless he be led there by the sovereign pontiff." Pope John Paul II in 1996. "Have no fear when men call me Christ on earth, for I am he." Pope Benedict in 2008. "You need not go to Christ for salvation. Come to me." Pope Francis in 2016. "Christ made himself sin, made himself the devil." That's new. "For our salvation. Only the church and its magisterium can claim holy infallibility." Have you had enough? I know I have. Well, is it any wonder that such a power-obsessed, megalomaniac religion makes itself unaccountable, sees nothing with its crimes, and uses the image and words of Christ himself to delude and soak its millions of dupe followers to believe that a bit of a communion wafer or a papal blessing or the right amount of cash delivered into church coffers will buy their way into heaven? As if one can. Well, unfortunately, I saw it for myself when I was last in Rome in 2011. Right there in the Vatican Museum, a display board for buying indulgences, just like out of Martin Luther's day. Special papal blessings cost you only 150 euros. The more you spend, the closer you get to heaven. Although, be warned, apparently, according to the sign, apparently God prefers credit cards to cash. How right when Pope Leo in 1520 said, "This myth of Christ has served us well." Well, the most dangerous group in the world is a super wealthy cult that sees itself as God, superior to everyone, and therefore justified in doing whatever is needed to protect itself and rule the world. A cult, in other words, like the Church of Rome. What other being than a cult can operate according to a criminal policy like Crimen Solicitanus, which has been binding on all Catholics since the year 1929. That policy states that whenever a child is raped or otherwise harmed by a priest, the police are not to be told, the victim is to be silenced, and if anyone speaks of this, they are excommunicated, thrown into hell for snitching on a rapist. Clearly, the God of Rome, like the Mafia, cannot tolerate a snitch. Better instead to operate under a global criminal conspiracy to aid and abet child rapists and killers than to cost the church a lawsuit or save a child's life. Heaven forbid. And yet, despite all of this criminal arrangement, the world keeps wondering why there's so much child rape within the Church of Rome. Are we all that blind? Do we really think a lion isn't going to eat a gazelle? Well, John Acton, a British politician, said, "Absolute power corrupts absolutely." He was referring to the Church of Rome when he made that statement, something conveniently left out of the history books. The Church of Rome is absolutely corrupt, but it also corrupts whoever is near to it, like all who attend it, who fund it, who associate with it, or rent its halls, or smile on its policies, or look the other way at all its public relations gestures. All who do so partake in that corruption. And under the law of God and mankind, those human accessories are equally guilty of all its crimes. The only good that can be said to come out of this most violent, corrupt, and anti-Christ body in history is how its evil awakens people to the need for a return to the simple words, witness, and spirit of Jesus himself, a spirit that has always been the chief adversary of the Church of Rome. Jesus founded a community of called-out people, a remnant not of this world, a congregation, not a church. Nowhere did Jesus speak of popes, of bishops, of rituals and ceremonies by which someone would mediate him and God to others. He said that the kingdom of heaven lay inside each of us, not outside in a communion wafer or a religious ritual. That inner kingdom of Christ alone is the guide of all true Christians, who must come out from and be separate from all these vile, false and violent churches that deny God in practice and kill children in practice. And that's the task of any deluded soul still caught in the fatal grip of Rome and its blasphemous illusions and depravities. As America's founding father said, we hold this truth to be self-evident. And one of those men, the second U.S. president, John Adams, said, quote, "A free government and the Roman Catholic religion can never exist together in any nation or country. Liberty and popery are opposed," unquote. The nature of an ancient corporate evil like the Church of Rome does not change over time. It simply alters its appearance, because it comes out of the dark ruler of this world, the one whom Jesus said, "He is a lie from the beginning, for he is the father of lies," Satan. It's a good thing to free ourselves from a lie as huge as Roman Catholicism and as criminal. As freeborn men and women, we are made for the truth, and when we recognize it, our hearts and our minds breathe freely and we return to our natural sense of liberty and independence. From that place of freedom, we are empowered to take action to stop criminals in every high place, whether they be popes or presidents or prime ministers. For we, the people, are the source of all sovereignty, of government, of law, and of religion. We can and must stop and arrest and confine child-raping priests when the police and courts refuse to do so. We can and must shut down the churches that traffic children and have hidden their crimes over centuries, like the Catholic Church, the Anglican Church of England, the United Church of Canada, all of these criminal bodies. For the life of one child is more sacred than all the fanfare and rituals of any church anywhere. Well, Jesus had his own prescription for child killers. He said, "Whoever would harm one of these innocent ones should have a millstone placed around his neck and be thrown into the sea." Well, I wonder what Jesus would say about an entire institution that mocks God, murders with impunity, rapes and murders children, and protects those who do so. Is there a millstone that is big enough to sink such an institution? Yes, there is. It is we, the people. I thank you.
Thank you. the bastards drop down dead. Next time you see me, I may be smiling. Bella ciao, bella ciao, bella ciao, ciao, ciao. I'll be in prison or on the TV.
If you can't go on any longer, take the hand held by your brother. Every victory gonna bring another. Carry it on, carry it on, carry it on, carry it on. There's a man by my side walking. There's a voice within me talking. There's a word